is the executive officer's report, I believe.
Actually, next item is item 9, consideration of issues to address in a climate change protection policy.
Okay, you wanted me to postpone till past. Oh. I didn't realize you wanted it to the very end for the executive director's report, but we'll go.
Oh, sorry.
Update on the consideration of issues to address climate change. And I'll call on Alita.
Okay, I think for this presentation, I'd very much like to be someone else, and it's Aladade Mangelsdorf, as shown on the slide.
Nice.
So. Again, I'm a senior environmental scientist with your staff. Now I'm here to open up what we hope to be a series of workshops and ongoing educational opportunity for us all on the topic of climate change. And in this particular case, the item is consideration of issues to address in a climate change policy. I have with me today Max Gomberg, who is an environmental program manager with the State Board and is focused on the issues of climate change and conservation. This is Max. And then next to him is Dr. Nat Seavey, who is a research director with the Point Blue Conservation Service and or conservation science and focused on Pacific Coast and Central Valley areas. So I'll start, and then this is a panel presentation with their involvement as well. So climate change is a recognized phenomena with observable implications for human and environmental health. There are a series of predictions of potential effects that we will likely see here in the North Coast region, including extended periods of drought punctuated by larger and flashier storms, warmer air temperatures and water temperatures, a greater percentage of precipitation falling as rain, altered fire regime, an alteration in ecological assemblages, a rise in sea level and saltwater intrusion. These are the kind of effects that we expect to see throughout California, but certainly along the coast. In March of this year, you adopted the 2014 Triennial Review of Our Basin Plan, which endeavors to assess the ways in which the Basin Plan could be updated to address emerging issues. And noted as a high priority was consideration of a policy to address climate change impacts on water quality. In that item, we talked about this project not being focused exclusively on the development of a policy, but also offering a range of other potential outcomes as a result of the research that will go into this project, including the development of new permit conditions, CEQA requirements, 401 certification requirements. Perhaps the board will be interested in adopting a resolution on the topic of climate change and our interests and focus as a board, in addition to the potential of developing a policy. There's also, as noted by the executive assistant executive officer in Region 4, the LA region, the potential outcome, at least in the long term, if not immediately, of needing to reevaluate beneficial uses and water quality objectives. What we have in mind to initiate this particular project is today's workshop as a part one, followed by a part two coming either later in this year or early next year. Part one today is simply an introduction to the topic of climate change and sort of an overview of the policy and science issues as they relate to the North Coast, and then an opportunity to hear just general concerns from yourself and from the audience about the kinds of issues that we should be contemplating, pursuing, research we should be thinking about when talking about climate change. In part two, we have in mind a full day workshop with the board, which could involve a morning full of panel discussions with technical experts in various fields, and then could also involve an afternoon where we break out into smaller groups to have more controlled discussion on individual topic areas. And some of those topic areas might include areas of special interests to you as individual board members, perhaps a breakout group on ocean conditions, maybe one on groundwater, maybe one on forestry, maybe one on infrastructure, stream and wetlands, and agriculture. And the idea with breakout sessions would be to focus the group energy on addressing a series of questions common to all of the breakout groups when thinking about a particular topic area and the potential impacts of climate change and the kinds of things that we need to know more about and the kind and the direction that we as a board think we would like to go. So today we have Max Gomberg, Environmental Program Manager of the Climate and Conservation Program of the State Board. He'll be talking about policy development in the state. And then following him will come Dr. Nat Seavey, Research Director for Pacific Coast and Central Valley at Point Blue, which is a conservation organization. And he'll give an overview of the existing science and implications for water quality. I think what we'll do is offer an opportunity for questions and answers after each of the presentations. And then following that, I can talk about next steps and we can open it up for public comment. And with that, I'll turn it over to Max.
Thank you, Alita. As Alita said, I'm Max Gomberg. I'm with the State Board, and I'm in the Office of Research Planning and Performance, and I run our climate program and now our water conservation program as well. And so I was asked to come here today to just sort of give you an overview of what's going on at the state level. I've been doing this with a number of regional boards. I was in San Diego yesterday at Region 9, so it's good to see all of the regional boards sort of taking this on. What I want to leave you with today is that climate change is huge, and we have two key facets of climate change that we're grappling with in California, which is mitigation, reducing our contribution to climate change, and then adaptation, which is adjusting and responding, creating resilience to the effects that we're already experiencing. So it's the magnitude of what we're dealing with is truly beyond what we've understood in the past. And I want to leave you with the impression that there are things, discrete things, that you can do as a board to grapple with this that don't require sort of a huge program and huge adjustments. So I want to start in the realm of psychology. Some of you may be familiar with the Kubler-Ross model of grief. There are five stages, right? So we've got denial, followed by anger, followed by bargaining, followed by depression, and then finally acceptance. So I want to talk through how do we get to acceptance of the need to deal with climate change and what the regional boards can do and what this regional board can do. So if we think through it, denial, thankfully, is something that we don't have to deal with too much in California. That only seems to afflict certain aspects of our national policy. But in terms of the second stage of anger, again, we also don't see that too much. We generally see it from the industries that are most affected, for example, say the coal industry. But again, in California, we've got a whole range of policies that were started under the prior administration, have continued through under the current administration to reduce our impact on the emission of greenhouse gases. And those are continuing, and most of the major players in the state are behind that as a state policy goal. So then we get to bargaining in the stages of grief here. And the way we tend to bargain about climate change is we tend to look at an issue like sea level rise, and the science is still imprecise on sea level rise. There was a report out from the National Research Council a few years back that said by the end of the century, which by the way is not that far away, a child born today, high likelihood of being alive at the end of the century, could that the sea level rise by 2100 could range from about a foot and a half to 5 feet. Well, the magnitude of impact from the low end to the high end is really dramatic. So depending on how conservative we want to be, it really will affect how much, you know, money we spend, what policy and regulatory tools we employ. So it's the bargaining is on, well, are we going to be conservative or not? So we see some of that going on. But I would say mostly where we are as a society and as a state is we're in the depression stage. We're in the depression stage because the magnitude of the impacts from climate change is large, and the way we've tried to grapple with it is to sort of plan and assess. We've done lots of vulnerability assessments. We've created lots of tools to look at all of the impacts, and we focused on the first order impacts. So that's the forest fires and the floods when we do get rain, and the droughts like the one we're in right now, and the changes in the hydrograph in general, the shrinking of our snowpack, and extreme heat days, and all of the immediate impacts that we're already seeing. And that doesn't even get us sort of to the second and third order effects, like when we do have fires and then the vegetation that was there doesn't grow back. We get different vegetation, and then that changes the hydrograph even further as a third order effect. So it's a little bit daunting. And what I want to suggest is we can move from the depression stage to the acceptance stage, but it's going to require a commitment to exercising collectively as regulatory bodies our authority and a willingness to, as a society, to spend money. Because a lot of what we have to do to adjust and protect, in particular, our most vulnerable populations is going to cost money. Whether it's, retreating or armoring the coast, critical facilities, whether it's requiring additional mitigation, so say, for example, additional shading of streams to keep that cool water habitat there because the water temperature is going up. The whole suite of actions are not without a price. So I think if there's one thing I want to leave you with, it is that we have to be cognizant of the true financial impact of what action requires, and of course then what would the implications of inaction be in terms of the impacts from extreme events such as fires, and extreme storms. And while we tend to say to the media at the state level, don't write so many darn articles about El Nino because we don't know yet if it's actually going to produce the rainfall that we're looking for. There is a possibility growing stronger that we're going to get one hell of a winter and have all kinds of flooding issues, which will, of course, impact all the things you've been discussing earlier today, in particular sediment loads, right? So it's sort of a big range of things. And I think what I've seen regional boards doing is sort of, okay, listing out, all of the impacts and then talking about how they affect all the programs. And that's a good first step. But what I want to suggest is that trying to take it all on is really too large of a task. And the best thing that, again, collectively the boards can do is focus on the major program areas that we're already working on and begin to build in the science and begin to think about each decision that's being made, such as the one you voted on this morning. How is that in support of adaptation to climate change? Is it supporting, if possible, reduction in greenhouse gas emissions? That's the key parameter to look at. So, a good adaptation program doesn't mean abandoning our water quality goals wholesale, but it does mean acknowledging that, our ecosystems, our coastal streams are changing. They're getting warmer. They may go from ephemeral to intermittent, right? We're going to see all these changes, I'm sure. Dr. Seavey will talk about a lot of this. And so figuring out when each time an item's before you, what is it that you're voting on that can support our climate goals, I think is really the key thing, again, that I want to leave with you. I just want to tell you a couple things that are going on at the state level that are I think most relevant right now. One is last year there was legislation passed that created a sea level rise database, which is maintained by our state's Natural Resources Agency. So every state agency, including all the regional boards that have coastline, have to report into this database what actions they're taking that are supporting sea level rise response. And then all that information will be publicly available so different government entities can look and see what others are doing. The Coastal Commission just finalized its sea level rise guidance policy, which is something I would recommend that staff look at. And then the governor just recently issued an executive order, B-30-15, which commits the state to a whole bunch of actions, but in particular tasks the Office of Planning and Research with coming up with a technical advisory group on how state entities can build in climate adaptation into their infrastructure decisions and into their analyses. So looking at when state agencies are making decisions, how do you use life cycle cost analysis to look at, well, if the cost of something is X today, but given different sensitivity analysis, it'll be Y 20, 40 years from now, how does that affect the decision we make? So those are two efforts that are ongoing and are worth being aware of. The office that I run at the state is small. We can help. We're here to help and definitely want to support your staff. But we're also looking to the regional boards to take this on. And the assistant executive officers have been collecting information on what all the regional boards are doing and sort of putting that together. So we're going to have a document soon which will you'll be able to look at and see, okay, what's Region 2 doing, what's Region 3 doing, and be able to take ideas from there as well. So without further ado, I think I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Seavey, but I'm happy for the opportunity. I'm glad that your staff is taking this on and happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Max. You'll be happy to know that of the five psychological levels you've identified, I've embraced two of them. I accept that I'm depressed. I thank you. I mean, it's nice to know that we have a liaison at Sacramento. I'm trying to think of a direct link to water quality and climate change or what we're doing to the atmosphere. You know, there's so much information coming out of UC Riverside looking at atmospheric nitrogen deposition and how it's fertilizing streams and changing Lake Tahoe. And even though the North Coast isn't as bad as the Southern California deserts or Lake Tahoe in terms of tons of atmospheric nitrogen as a result of fossil fuel burning being deposited, I think it's important to take back to the state that, you know, symbolism in this arena, I think, is going to be important. How does the state lead by example? And as technologies emerge and as technologies get better, you know, having state automotive fleets transfer to electronic or electric cars versus, you know, carbon-burning cars. But I think those kinds of actions, actions speak louder than words. And so I think we need to start thinking about how we as public servants can lead by example. And I hope, you know, through your efforts, you could push some of your peers down in Sacramento where there's a lot of cars. The more we can show that we're actually trying to walk the walk and not just talk the talk, that makes a big impression on folks. So that's my two cents.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Max, thanks. I believe that you were at WKCC last year, right?
I was.
I really appreciated the discussion. Then the one thing I've tried to think about some is that, you know, Port of Colón, it's all in all its wisdom, never contemplated climate change. And so You know, in fact, I would guess that those two words are probably not paired together in all of Puerto Cologne. And so, you know, when I look at it in the context of as a regulatory process, you know, we look at things of beneficial use. That's what our charter is to protect and enhance beneficial uses. And so I could see the linkage. I would be very interested, and I would encourage the sharing of information. WQCC kind of set that up, at least on some of the wetland type things and some of the resiliency type things that we're talking about. At the same time, I'd be very interested in regulatory authority as it relates to Puerto Cologne and beneficial use to those pairings. Those are not natural pairings that we've dealt with primarily. I think every region probably has very unique things that they're dealing with, and that I'd be very interested in anything that we could get as guidance for an agency, for a board, for our legal, that we could better understand our footing and what we're trying to do. AB 32, you're right. I mean, that started a while back under Schwarzenegger, and Governor Brown's been very progressive about his push towards climate change and the reaction and what we do with this. And I think that we're all trying to grapple with that. I would look for anything the State Board, your office, or anybody else could lend. And then I think we exchange that information at all chances to, you know, ourselves adapt to this, because we're dealing with something that is not necessarily straight ahead in the context of water quality regulatory process.
I take your points, and, you know, we will be trying to develop something that's useful for all the regional boards. As you say, the circumstances are unique in different parts of the state. And but on your point of authorities, while it's true, as you say, you know, Puerto Cologne didn't really contemplate climate change, broadly the board's authorities to protect beneficial uses and water quality, so in many ways there are linkages when you look at, you know, all of the land use issues that are coming up, all of the coastal protection issues. If you've got, take the Humboldt Bay region, you know, sea level rise and storm surge affecting coastal infrastructure to the extent that that's impacting the water quality, because things are being washed into the water or otherwise, right? I think there's a clear nexus for the board to act.
Agreed. I totally agree with you. But take that a couple steps further. Right. Somebody wants to upgrade a wastewater treatment plant. We then look at it and say, you know what? We think you ought to build this 6-foot wall instead of a 2-foot wall, and that adds a tremendous cost to a project. And where does our authority lie? Can we in effect use that as a guidance? How do we do that? And that's kind of thing that, you know, I agree with what you're saying completely. It's not that hard to get there. But at the same time, there are things that extend beyond just the normal here, straight up beneficial use type stuff that is going to take some real creative imagination, I think. And it's going to have to be bound and legal, I believe, because it's going to test our authority.
And I think what I would say to you is be proactive. Test your authority. We will back you up. that may not be what you want to hear, but
I like the backing up part. I just remember it.
I appreciate that. I just don't want to be Charlie Brown, you know, waiting for the football, you know, and going to kick it, you know, I'm going to hold the football for you, Charlie Brown, just kick it. And this is just super duper important. And I'm just looking for any and all tools that we get and understanding of this.
Right. Well, let me just leave you with the one example of a wastewater treatment plant. This was a Region 3. This was the Morro Bay down on the Central Coast. Their wastewater plant is right on Morro Bay, at the bottom, like so many wastewater plants are. And it was still doing sort of advanced primary treatment. It needed to be upgraded. The city wanted to just upgrade it on site. And it took getting us, the regional board, and the Coastal Commission staff on a call to make sure that we were all aligned on saying that was not going to be acceptable, right? And even though it was going to cost, I think it was $20-25 million more to move it back and up the hill, that was what we were going to require. And we got there, and it was a difficult political process for the local officials, but we got there. So we're going to see more of that.
You bet. Thank you, by the way.
And I don't know whether you've looked at it, but sort of marine maven Meg Caldwell out of Stanford University associated with oceans policy, she wrote up a booklet that we're going to evaluate our regional board on basically legal authority of the regional board and the marine environment, and that's the tiny segment of rising oceans and that portion. And it seems to me that's a base document that could be tweaked to really lay out our authority. And we're going to be, that's part of our plan to look at that, but just as a suggestion. And then I really like the idea of a state registry, because I've been to a lot of climate change conferences. I don't want to go to anymore unless we're interested in product.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's critical, right? We've reached the stage where additional studies is not going to achieve what we need, which is action.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Nat Seavey from Point Blue Conservation Science, and really appreciate the invitation to be here today and talk to you a little bit about our work and climate models in general and what they're able to tell us. To give you a little bit of background about myself, I grew up in Washington State and went to graduate school at the University of Florida, and eventually ended up here in the San Francisco Bay region, and I've been here for about 10 years now. So I work for Point Blue Conservation Science. Our mission is to advance the conservation of birds, other wildlife, and ecosystems through science, partnerships, and outreach. We were founded in 1965 as the Point Reyes Bird Observatory. We have about 140 staff and seasonal scientists, and we work from the Sierra to the sea. Now, our perspective, where we're coming from, is that we're really totally reliant on nature. And we're reliant on ecosystem services that are provided. And those are things that the provisioning services that are things like fresh water, food, fisheries, wood for fiber and fuel. The regulating services of climate, flood protection, water quality. And then also cultural services that come along with that. And we see climate change as something, one of the major lens through which we'll view all of these services that nature provides over the next century and beyond. And so, as Max was saying, there is a large price tag in terms of thinking about what climate adaptation is. And I think one of the opportunities is to think about that price tag as being the way that we think about managing these ecosystem services in the face of climate change. So with that framing in mind, what I'd like to do today is talk about three things. I'd like to start out with a little bit about how climate models work and just give everybody a very basic background on that. I'll then talk a little bit about what those climate models are telling us about what's coming next in California, and specifically Northern California, with how those are related to water quality. And then finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about how do we prepare for an uncertain future. And I'd like to, you know, kind of start to think about what are the products that might come out and what's the process toward getting to those products that we can use these climate models to help us with. So to begin with, general circulation models, also called GCMs, are what we use to describe our climate. And so we can think of these as simply wrapping a gigantic grid around the Earth, and each of those grid cells incorporates a whole bunch of equations. And those equations describe the physical processes by which energy flows between those different cells and between those cells and the ocean and between those cells and the land. And so those include things like solar radiation, and then the terrestrial radiation is that energy is reflected back, how the water cycles from the ocean and the land up into the atmosphere and then falls back as precipitation. So there's all of those things built into these GCMs. Now, there's several different climate models, and they're typically identified by some sort of 4 to 5 letter code that stands usually for the group of researchers that's promoting that particular model. And each of those models has a slightly different set of equations and assumptions about how the atmosphere works. So the important thing to realize is that when we talk about climate models, we're usually talking about a set of several climate models. And one of the things to look for is whether or not those models agree with each other or not. Now, these models allow us to estimate the impact of different things that influence the atmosphere. And one of the things that we've been focusing on is greenhouse gases. So greenhouse gases, and there are 3 major ones. This graph shows the concentration of 3 of those in our atmosphere since 1850. And those are carbon dioxide in the green, methane in the orange, and then nitrous oxide in the red. And all of them have been increasing. And so what we can do is we can look at how temperature has changed across the globe since 1850, and then we can go into the climate models and change the greenhouse gases that are in those models and other things that we know are important, and use that to generate information about how well this change in the greenhouse gas concentration explains the changes in temperature that we've seen. And what we find is that greenhouse gases explain a lot of the observed warming. So that black bar on top is the observed warming. It's about 0.7 degrees Celsius between 1950 and 2010. The green bar represents the contribution, the effect that we think that increase in greenhouse gases would have had. Now you see that that's slightly more than that black bar. And that's because at the same time that we've had increases in greenhouse gases, we've also had changes in other anthropogenic factors. So one of those is soot in the atmosphere that blocks light coming in. And so that actually has a slight cooling effect. And so we can look at that combined forcing, and it matches very well with the observed warming. And then we can also include in these models other forcings, such as the particulates from volcanoes, solar energy, all of those things, and look at the amount of that. So this is a graph from the latest IPCC report. IPCC is the International Panel for Climate Change, and a lot of the figures that I'll show come directly from that latest report. They're also using these global models to help us understand what the downstream impacts have been. And their conclusions have been that the greenhouse gases, that accumulation, has more likely than not increased the risk of heat waves, contributed to changes in wind patterns that affects storm tracks, and contributed to sea level rise during the later half of the 20th century. So here's the real challenge with those global climate models, and that is that if we look on the left, those grid cells represent the grid cells that we cover the globe with and do that modeling on. So, you know, you look at those, and in the box there, you can see that California has, you know, one grid cell goes all the way across California. So those are huge relative to the variability that we know exists in California that we need to know about in order to make decisions. And so there's a process called downscaling, and downscaling is the process of taking these very broad, generalized climate models on these large grids and taking them down to a resolution that is applicable to the types of decisions that we need to make. Now, I'm not going to go into all the different types of downscaling. There's several different approaches. I'd simply be aware that this is a really active area of research, and how we do this has a lot, it's one of the sources of uncertainty in the conclusions that we can make. Okay, so with that background in climate models and how they work and what we've used them to understand about changes in the past, I'd like to now kind of look forward and talk about how we use climate models to project what conditions will be like in the future, to think about how much greenhouse gases will increase, and how that will affect temperature, precipitation, sea level rise, and then ultimately a lot of the ecological effects of climate change that contribute to the concerns we have about the natural resources in the area. So one of the first things to realize is that these climate models don't tell us how much greenhouse gases will change. That's something that will really depend on the choices that we make as society, you know, both here and globally. And so to deal with this, what the IPCC has done has come up with a number of RCP scenarios. And those are representative concentration pathways. And those describe how greenhouse gases will change in the future. And the point being here that those could continue to rise based on the red line, or they could go down, you know, if you look those one of those blue lines. And so how those concentrations change has a huge influence on how much temperature change we'd see in the future or how much sea level rise. So this is one of the uncertainties that we have to deal with in the climate models when we're trying to interpret the outputs. So in California, we have a lot of certainty that temperatures will increase. So if we look at this example, those are three different climate models, the CCSM, BCCR, and MIROC. And the color gradients go from 0 up to about 12 degrees Fahrenheit temperature increase by 2100. And you can see that for all three of those examples, that California is someplace between about 7 and 9 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of 2100. And one of the ways we then express the results of several models like that is having some multi-model mean, so taking the average of all of those. Now we can contrast that with what the projections are for precipitation. So in this case, 0 is in the middle there with tan and blue, right? And then if we go bluer, we're getting more precipitation by 2100. If we go to red, we're getting less. And you can see that we've got two models that project less precipitation and one model that predicts more. And then we can go to that multi-model mean and we get an increase in precipitation. But when you interpret that, you need to realize that you know, that's an average, and you actually have two different models that are projecting a decrease. So there's simply a lot of uncertainty about the direction that precipitation will go, and that's one of the things that we're really challenged by in terms of climate modeling. Now, even if we do have an increase in precipitation, one of the things is that as temperature goes up, we end up with less snow because more of that precipitation falls as rain. So this is a graph that shows the reduction of the projected snow water equivalent starting with what we have today and then going up through 2100, and that in California, that's 43% in the future. And then climate change also creates sea level rise, and it creates it in several different ways. One is simply that as the globe warms up, the water that's in the ocean expands. So that's thermal expansion that in this graph is referred to as density changes. At the same time, we also have ice that's melting, and that's adding water into the oceans at the same time. There's also, as that ice is changing, you have slight shifts in the elevation of the actual land surface. So the sea level rise models, like the climate models, are trying to capture all of these different effects that are driving changes in sea level. As a result, as was mentioned earlier, there's a lot of uncertainty in the climate change model, the sea level rise models that are out there. This is a report that summarizes sea level rise for the coasts of California, Oregon, and Washington. And the blue line represents Oregon and Washington sea level rise. The orangish line there is the California. And the important thing is that by 2030, we could be looking at up to about 30 centimeters of sea level rise. And by 2100, as was mentioned earlier, we could be looking at, you know, 3-4 feet very easily. There's actually been a more recent report out that has said, you know, some of these relationships we might not have completely right, and this could actually happen much faster. And so one of the real challenges is that we're faced with trying to make decisions, you know, toward a target that will most likely be changing. Okay, so those are the physical things going on. One of the really interesting things is to start to look at the ecological consequences, and this is what a lot of our work involves with. So I just picked 3 different examples. These aren't all our work, but just I thought interesting California examples. One is wildfire. So they've done wildfire modeling for California, looking at what the projected conditions would mean. And you can see that in this graph, Northern California and especially the Northwest California really pops out as having a lot more fire that would be burning there. So the red would be up to 4 times the amount of fire that you experience right now. For river flows, the graph shows river flows for the Klamath River and the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. There's a December-March bar there, which has a little bit more flow as you have more rain falling during the winter. And then in April and July, you have less flow. So overall, the annual flow actually doesn't change very much, but you have a really big change in the timing of that that could be really important for both some of your infrastructure concerns and also wildlife habitat. And the last one is some work that we did at Point Blue on bird communities. The colors represent how different the bird community of the future is from today's bird community that's found in that same spot. We've done a lot of modeling about how birds will respond to climate change. And you can see that in this case, the Northwest California actually looks as though the bird communities will stay relatively stable relative to some of the other areas of California. So the point being that there's a lot of different ways that climate change is going to touch down in California, and there's going to be a lot of regional variability. Here's one more, since we're sitting in Sonoma. You know, wine, if you look at that graph on the left, it shows all the different varieties of grapes. They have a temperature, you know, an optimal temperature that they grow at, and people are using climate models to look at how the suitability across Northwest North America will change for growing grapes. So the red is areas that are currently suitable that will decrease in suitability in the future. The greens are areas that are currently suitable that will retain that suitability. And then the blues are areas that increase in suitability with climate change. And it's interesting on one hand to think about, okay, well, how does this impact the vineyards that are here right now? The other thing to think about is, okay, for all those blue areas, what will be the increased water demands and the other impacts that come along with that that we'll need to plan for in the future? Okay, so there's just a brief, you know, a very high-level overview of some of the things that are changing. And I think that the interesting thing is, how do we go from those kinds of projections to some sort of product? And I think that's a really great question that you're asking. So as an organization, we're looking at climate smart conservation as a way that we deal with this in a conservation context. And for us, climate smart conservation addresses impacts of climate change at the same time that we're looking at other environmental threats. So all of the other environmental challenges that we have are still going to be out there. And what we need to think about is, okay, how does climate change intersect with those? And what can we do to address both of them at the same time? And in doing that, you know, we want to look for nature-based solutions that provide both for wildlife and for people, so that in the future we have diverse ecosystems, that we can reduce climate risks both to humans and to our natural communities, And we can increase our ability to respond and adapt, that adaptation that Max was talking about. And also that when we can, we look for opportunities to design these solutions in a way that they reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that's that mitigation piece of it. So some of the key principles that we try to put in place when we're thinking about these kinds of things is, one, focusing on future conditions. So, you know, rather than just designing to what we've seen in the past, thinking about how do we look forward to this range of possibilities and design towards those. Designing actions in a watershed ecosystem context, so trying to think about the larger system whenever possible. Solutions out there that are flexible and adaptive, recognizing that what we're planning for today may not be what we're planning for tomorrow. Prioritizing actions that have multiple benefits for both people and wildlife, and then collaborating and communicating across sectors. And I'll add a sixth one to this, and that's showing our work. So, you know, recognizing that the decision we make today about a solution is going to be built on a bunch of assumptions about how much we think sea level is rising or how quickly we think temperature is changing. It's important for us to record that information in a way that when somebody goes back to evaluate that action, they can understand what our assumptions were that went into that decision-making process. So I'll give you a few of the projects that Point Blue has been involved with in trying to bring people together and help them start to think about some of these challenges. So this is our Coast Our Future website, which is a collaboration of Point Blue, NOAA, and the USGS that allows people to look at different sea level rise and storm scenarios and then plan for those. Any of you could go sign up for this right now. The limitation is that right now it just goes up as far as Bodega Bay, but there is the work that's going on right now to extend what I'm showing you up as far as Point Arena and up the Russian River to about as far as Guerneville. So it's a website, and once you're on that website, you can choose different combinations of flooding, of sea level rise and storm surges, and look at how that those combine to impact inundation. So here I'll just draw your attention to two areas, the light blue and then the green. And the light blue there over on the right-hand shore is flooding that you would expect under current conditions. And the green are areas that are vulnerable to flooding but currently protected by some sort of infrastructure. So this is Bodega Bay. So now we can look at today's sea level with a 20-year storm event. And you can see that under that we have quite a bit of flooding. We have areas that are vulnerable that are pushed back. That is, you know, starting to flood back there toward 101. And now what I'm going to show you is I'm just going to change it so that we're not looking at any, we're again not looking at any storm event, but we're looking at 50 centimeters of sea level rise. Okay, and that looks like this. So if we go back and forth, so 50 centimeters of sea level rise looks about like the inundation we'd expect from a 20-year storm event. And then we can look at both the 50 centimeters of sea level rise plus the 20-year storm event, and we can see that we have much more extensive flooding. So this is just one example of the types of tools that start to allow people to come together and visualize this. Now, this isn't what you're going to use to, you know, as for that final analysis about how high the seawall needs to be around your wastewater treatment plant, but I think it starts to help point in the direction of where might the vulnerabilities be and where might it be really important to invest in some additional modeling. These are coarse models that we try to do for the, you know, the entire coast all at once or large sections of the coast. And in doing that kind of coarse thing, we lose some, you know, some of the finer details that will be important for some of these final decisions. I'll do another example, because one of the assumptions in what I just showed you is that there's relatively little ecological change that goes on. So thinking more about some of our tidal marsh systems in San Francisco Bay, one of those things is that they are constantly replenished by the amount of sediment that comes in. But in San Francisco Bay, we don't have a lot of information about exactly how fast that sediment is accumulating in different marshes. So this is Santa Bonita Marsh here, and that area is just outside of a highly developed area. And what we can do is we can look at the sea level rise and what we would expect based with modeling that's been done under a high sedimentation rate and a low sedimentation rate. So as you go across those bars, you're moving through years from 2010 up to 2110. And if there's a lot of sediment coming into the system, we can maintain that mid-marsh. If we don't have that sediment coming in, if there's low sedimentation, then we start to transition to low marsh and eventually to the mudflat. So we're slowly losing that mid-marsh out there because there's not enough sediment coming into the system to keep up with sea level rise. Now, this has important consequences for the wildlife habitat out there. It also has impacts on these communities. Okay, so this graph is the same as the last one, except instead of showing you the amount of different habitat types out there, it's showing the wave energy that ends up on the shoreline. And we can then look at that wave energy. So right now, most of that wave energy is out there at the edge of that high marsh. And then in the low sedimentation example, as we step through time, that wave energy starts to come back and eventually ends up against those communities. So again, these are the types of tools that people are starting to make available so that in order to understand where the vulnerabilities are and what some of the things that communities can start thinking about are. And finally, one of the real challenges is thinking about, okay, how do we do the planning in the face of all of this uncertainty? And one of the tools that's out there is scenario planning, which is actually a formalized way of trying to understand how different decisions will play out under different futures. So this is something that's been used a lot in business planning. It's been used in military planning. And today it's being brought to natural resource planning to think about how we make decisions in the face of the uncertainty that we have to deal with in climate change. So in conclusion, I hope that I've given you a little bit of information about climate models, how they're used, what some of the uncertainties are, a little bit more about what these climate models are telling us about what's coming next in California. And some of the real challenges in going from these large climate models down to specific ecological impacts or local impacts of sea level rise that have a lot of sort of fine scale heterogeneity that plays into them. And then finally, some of the ways that we might think about using these models to prepare for an uncertain future and some of the decision making that we're all engaged with. So thank you very much. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions you have. And I've also included a list of some other resources that's in the handout that might be a good place to start for some more information. So thank you.
Great, thanks. John's just coming back. I'll just let him sit down. It's all you, John.
So with that, we've wrapped up our panel presentation, and I'd invite you to ask any questions you'd like.
Thanks. Yeah, it's really informative. I've been to a few climate change talks and sat on a couple panels myself, and it's nice to see that there's a lot of consistent information coming out now. I'd say over the past 10 years, there's been a lot of uncertainties with the GCM predictions and forecasting in certain areas where certain camps believe one thing and others believe another. But I think kind of at the statewide scale, things are on a real common theme right now. And I think that's advances in technology that we have and just probably a lot of collaboration of people getting on board with that. So it's nice to see that, and it becomes a useful planning tool. there, I know there's other areas, and I'm sure you're pretty well in tune with areas up and down the coast and communities that are doing this same type of modeling and prediction. I live in Eureka, and I know all around Humboldt Bay there's folks that are working on doing just that right now. So I just as your database grows and you're getting all up and down the coast, I'm imagining you're working with all these other locals to help integrate that and not reinvent the wheel.
Absolutely, and I know that conversation is going on right now with Southern California, and it was interesting. I don't directly work on most of the sea level rise modeling, but in preparing for this, I looked around the web and realized that there was this effort going on in Humboldt Bay and up around that area, and how those things all talk to each other is a great issue, right?
Sure.
And it's one of the places where I think the state and organizations like you can play a role of getting people together and one, making sure that the right kind of information is getting brought forward, and two, that it's being brought forward and used in a coordinated way.
Sure. I mean, obviously it's a concern at local government level, at state government level, at probably federal government level, and so with everybody gaining interest in that, just the nexus to get everybody to come together, and it's exciting to see it happening.
Yeah.
Thanks for the presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you both, all of you. Thank you. I would be interested in you know, you'd mentioned, Alita, I believe that we could do an expanded version of this and look at this broader. I'm curious, you know, the modeling, because of the noise or the uncertainty or the maybe the just the scale of some of those model predictions, how do you contemplate then bringing that into regulatory, because you've got such a wide kind of swath to look at it. Say you look at it from an infrastructure standpoint, you would, I assume, on an infrastructure standpoint, be looking to be fairly conservative, right, to use a higher predictive model, because the investment, I mean, I can't imagine even looking around Humboldt Bay, let alone San Francisco Bay, to think about the infrastructure implications and that kind of thing. So anything that we do, we'd want to at least look at it through the lens of making it real and making it last. So wouldn't you aim higher maybe at certain times to say, well, I mean, if a little is good, more is better at this point. If a two-foot wall will work for 30 years, maybe, gosh, you know, in the cost of concrete and the project that we're doing here, it might just be good to go 5 foot and build that into and some of that kind of added value into it. I don't, and maybe in the ecological, you know, it's more resiliency, that you build more resiliency into the ecological end of things. It just kind of, it really kind of bends my mind to think about some of this stuff and what we're really, really up against. And using models is a very interesting thing, because the models are not fine. They're not that fine resolution.
Yeah.
If I may, I mentioned earlier the Coastal Commission's guidance, which is now out, and that's essentially what they did. You know, they said, really, we need to use the upper range of things, because otherwise, right, we could end up making investments that are insufficient a few decades hence.
Well, and I think too, Max, you know, to come back to our earlier just exchange, you know, I think it would be of great value to have I'm really glad you're here, both of you guys, and the conversation to share this wide and far with all nine regional boards. Sometimes regional boards go solo, right, that we're just the North Coast, we're all great and groovy up here, and, you know, that stuff that happens in Mojave, whatever. You know, but in reality, you know, this is a time with all hands on deck, and that I think the opportunity then is to coordinate, exchange, and share, and learn as we go, because this is a very big deal.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Board Member Gustin.
Thank you. Excuse me. Setting aside for the moment, and particularly for you, Doctor, the fact that this is anthropogenic. I mean, it's human beings burning up carbon fuels, and that's where we get to. In a perspective of a geophysicist, how much change is this compared to, say, a few really good volcanoes that blow up, or in terms of the world? And I don't mean to denigrate the idea of global change or of climate change, but where are we in terms of, say, you know, a couple millennia? How big a deal is this? You know, at another level, if I were a child, am I supposed to be afraid of this, or is this just kind of, you know, the only thing that we can guarantee is change? And we seem to be giving that, and I'll let you take a shot at that.
Okay. So I heard two questions there, and one is, where are we now relative to a longer time scale? And the other is, thinking forward, is this something that will have a profound impact on the way that we experience the world? I don't have a figure here in front of me, but the greenhouse gas concentrations that we're at have been as high in the past. It was quite a while back, and when you look at what sea level rise was like, at what the sea level and the climate was like, it was a completely different world. So the levels that we're at now are certainly unprecedented in human history, and they will have a profound impact on the type of climate that we have. So that all said, I think that looking forward, I think we have a tremendous potential to shape the trajectory of the world that we live in, both by mitigating for greenhouse gases and also by taking the steps that we need to adapt and to provide the resiliency for both our society and for our natural ecosystems out there that we need to experience something like life as we know it now. I very much think that the world that, you know, our grandchildren live in will be very different from the world that we're in now, in terms of, you know, the temperature, the water availability, all of those things will be dramatically different. I think that there's completely an opportunity for us to continue to thrive in that environment, and we need to start taking steps to prepare for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you all for your presentations. I like being groovy. I'm okay with that. One of the things I've gotten to do in my day job is to correct people when they continue to talk about climate change as it's a futuristic coming event. And I think that's something that we can all do immediately is, you know, it's not coming, it's here, and we're dealing with it. The other thing, too, is what I reacted to in your in your projections of fire frequency in California is also, I think, a notion that we need to start pushing the paradigm that we don't have to accept more forest fires. We can prevent forest fires by taking affirmative actions and managing vegetation, whether it's prescribed burning, whether it's thinning of forests, whether it's, you know, it's sound vegetation management. So for us to sit here and wring our hands, it just perpetuates this trap that we've got ourselves into that, well, we can't do anything. We just have to put the fire out when it comes. And that is just not right. We could do a lot to manage vegetation, collect carbon, recycle that carbon in such a way that it doesn't get back in the atmosphere. So that's another another paradigm that I think we need to push back on. We don't have to just be spectators. We can be active managers on some of these things. As it relates to stream flow, I think that is a significant challenge. I wish Vivian was still here from the Fisheries Association, and I think it gets back to some of the challenges that we've been fighting this year with the Klamath fish and the presence of a pathogen that causes problems for salmon in warm water. You know, one of the things that I've been saying all along is, well, if we have less water but higher seas, that means the mouths of the river may close up sooner, and the fish will not be allowed to come up until the first freshet, until the first rain. That might be the best thing to happen for fish. Leave them in the ocean where they're safe and not bust open the sandbar and let them come up when the water's 75 degrees. So, again, just because we've done things in the past doesn't mean we have to keep doing it. We have to be thoughtful and we have to be smart. in terms of how we manage these resources. So I always appreciate it when people make me think, and that's what you did today. So thank you very much for coming and sharing your thoughts with us. Really appreciate it.
I just had one comment. I'm seeing a lot of this converted to dike discussions, and they're, at least what I've seen in Humboldt Bay, almost the entire focus is how do we build the dikes, and in some areas that'll be very effective, but other areas I think, you know, you've just thrown good money after bad, and but that's a very tough issue if you own land on the other side of a dike.
Isn't that, Mr. Chair, isn't that like building a 10-foot wall to stop immigrants when somebody's going to be selling an 11-foot ladder?
Yep. Yes. I won't quote you to Donald Trump. Or he has a solution, I'm sure. All right. Well, thank you. We're looking at this as a pretty exciting phase. We're building up to a workshop, and then, like I said, the real proof of the pudding of this board is whether we can come up with product. And so we really want that emphasized throughout after we further define the problem. I want to spend some time further defining the solutions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. It's exciting stuff. I'm over the depression part. I'm into giddy acceptance. And
still angry. You don't seem angry.
Okay, 10, Executive Director.